Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we're offering a free sample PDF of a recent Barnes Review issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. If you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, www.barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit www.barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550, White Plains, Maryland, 20695.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm joined by Remy Tremblay, a independent journalist and regular contributor to the Barnes Review. He is also the editor of the French-Canadian magazine, Le Harpong. Hi, Remy. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show today.
No problem. So, in the November-December edition of the Barnes Review, you wrote a piece titled Saint Joan of Arc, Her True Story, that went into great detail about the life of the French patron saint, Joan of Arc. And this piece was eye-opening because it's been a while since I've heard or read anything about Joan of Arc. And I was thoroughly delighted to read about her again in your piece. And I get the vague impression that Joan of Arc's legacy has gradually been downplayed by contemporary historians. Have you gotten that same impression as well?
I wouldn't go that way. Actually, Joan of Arc, Saint Joan of Arc, is very famous in France, and she is still celebrated like every year. Of course, when we read English historians, they will downplay her role. And there is a tendency to present her as xenophobic and, against, you know, like living together. But that being said, her memory is still very alive in France. And every year, except in 2023, where celebrations and commemorations were forbidden by the French state, she's still celebrated, like, every year.
Why were her celebrations prohibited in 2023?
This is a topic addressed in American Free Press at the time. Basically, in May is a period of different demonstrations in France. On May 1st, there will be the left demonstrating for for higher salaries and better wages and everything. Then there is also the week after, there's usually mass demonstrations of nationalists in Paris to commemorate the death of Sébastien Bézieux, who was a French nationalist activist who was killed by the police in 1994. So every year, there are huge demonstrations in honor of Sébastien. And this year, after the mass protests of Sébastien Bézieux, the government decided to ban anything that was like related to nationalism or so-called far right. So basically, the marches and demonstrations for Saint Joan of Arc were supposed to be held on the second Sunday of May. But all the commemorations, all the marches, demonstrations, and even seminaries, like lectures and conferences held by nationalist groups or identitarian organizations were simply banned.
So the key word here is nationalism, which is one thing I did gather from reading your piece, and we will definitely go into that further along the conversation. But before we dive deep into this conversation, could you give our listeners a brief overview of like the early stages of Joan of Arc's life and just her overall background?
Yeah, of course. Well, Joan of Arc came from a very modest family. Her father was a farmer, and she was raised as a devout Catholic, but she didn't know how to read nor how to write. She was living a simple life, something very common back in those days. And she was this is very important to remember, she was a very devout child. Now, she started seeing visions when she was in her early teenage years. And her visions told her to be more and more devout, to be extremely careful in reciting her prayers and following a devout path, if you will.
One thing I've also gathered from your piece is that history doesn't take place in a vacuum. And in Joan of Arc's case, she lived in a time of war, specifically the Hundred Year War between England and France, which spanned 1337 to roughly 1453, if I'm not mistaken. So I have like two questions here. What was the main cause for this conflict, and how was someone like Joan of Arc looped into this conflict in the end?
This conflict is extremely complicated to understand, but we need to remember that at that time there were no like official countries like we know them since the 19th century. Also, is different regions that would be under the sovereignty of a king, and sometimes they would change allegiance. But basically, we had a king in England and a king in France. But the king of England, after Normandy became English, the king of England had the will to rule over France. And France was living succession problems of its own. So basically, the war of 100 years is about the succession of the throne of France. So at the time of Joan of Arc, it was the Dauphin, who was Charles, who was later to be known as Charles VII, who was supposed to go on the throne of France. But Henry VI in England wanted to take the crown of France as well. In the north of France, the Burgundies decided to ally themselves with Henry VI, the English monarch, against Charles VII. So Charles VII was, at the moment of Joan of Arc, he was stuck in the south of France, and his territory was decreasing and shrinking under the attacks of the English and the Burgundies in the north. So Joan of Arc, the moment she was looped in in that story, the friends of Charles VII was losing ground. And eventually, if nothing had happened, it is likely we can assume that the Burgundies would have invaded the south of France, and then Charles VII would have never been king, and the English would have ruled France. Now, as for your question about how she got involved, basically, she had visions from St. Michael, and it is St. Michael's who urged her to take action. This is her visions told her that they're true or not depends on your faith, I guess. But it is after seeing St. Michael's talking to her that she decided to go see the king, the future king of France, Charles VII, to make him a king and to lead him into battle, to lead his army into battle.
Interesting. The idea of a female in combat in like the 15th century would just be far-fetched to the modern mind, because like, let's face it, at that time, there were much sharper distinctions
between the sexes, and it was virtually unheard of for females to take up arms in that epoch. Instead, they would be like expected to like raise a family or maybe toil in the fields to put food on the table. And perhaps if they have a surplus, sell it at a profit. But warfare was generally out of the question. So based on your research, how was Joan of Arc able to get on the battlefield?
As you said, it was like extremely rare. I know the Celts had some heroines of the kind, but in like Middle Ages, it was something like you would never see. Now, how did she convince the king to lead his army? Well, she was finally introduced to the king in 1429. However, the king, Charles, was not totally sure about her own visions and her own claims about her visions. So he decided not to be dressed as a king, but as a simple soldier among his vassals. Well, she recognized him. Even though he was dressed very humbly, very modestly, she recognized him in the crowd of vassals. And he first denied being the king. And she repeatedly told him, "It is you, the future king of France, and you will be crowned." So after this first encounter, the future king seemed somehow to believe the claims of Saint Joan of Arc. He nevertheless asked some priests to make sure she was not a heretic and that she was really their claims were true. And the priest said that it was okay, that basically her claims were likely to be true, although they had no evidence, and that she was not a heretic. In order to investigate a little bit further, the king asked Joan of Arc about a prayer that he had made. He said, "Do you know anything about it?" And they had a private conversation. We have no document on what was said during the private conversation between the king and Joan of Arc, but we know that afterwards, the king totally trusted Joan of Arc. So this is how he decided to go against the Moors of the time, if you will, and let her dress as a man and let her lead the armies to Orleans.
Going back to one point you raised about just the nationalistic aspect of Joan of Arc, because I think there is something there that you mentioned, how in the Franco sphere, her legacy is much more well known. And I would even venture to say that if you're plugged into the Catholic network, because that's how I learned about Joan of Arc in a Spanish mass when I was growing up in the United States, Juana de Arco, as we would say it. And her legacy is one of like legends, and especially her exploits on the battlefield. So what were some of like the biggest accomplishments she had during her time going to war against English forces?
Well, the biggest feat, I would say, was the Siege of Orleans. She broke the siege. The siege has been going for a very long time. And France, like Charles VII, was actually losing Orleans. The king, Charles VII, had been losing a lot of battles. And he was on the downside, if you will. His war was not going very well. And the end was near. So with the siege of Orleans, that was won by Joan of Arc, who actually led the French troops. There was a reversal in the situation. And afterwards, French were able to win major victories. So she was able to lead the armies of France until they broke at the doors of Paris. But the Siege of Orleans is clearly the most celebrated accomplishment of Joan of Arc. The victory of Orleans.
Now, one thing I've also noted is, and this is becomes quite obvious is that her fame is largely due to her tragic fate at the hands of English and French collaborators. What ultimately led to her tragic demise?
She was captured by the Burgundy. So basically, the Burgundy were the allies of the English. And they set up in an ecclesiastic trial. So priests from the University of Paris, which was English territory at the time, held a trial in which they asked her several like questions during days and days and days. They asked her questions to prove that she was a heretic. However, the point that she was really proven guilty of was cross-dressing, which is forbidden. So the Burgundy and the priest of Paris, especially Cochon, proved her guilty of being heretical. What is extremely disturbing in the story is that Charles VII could have intervened, but he did not make any intervention to try to save Joan of Arc from her English tormentors. In the end, she was proven guilty by the University of Paris court, and she was burnt as a witch, as a heretic. Yeah.
That's interesting how Charles VII did not intervene. What is the general historical consensus behind his decision not to step in and prevent her execution?
Well, at that moment, after several victories, the French had stopped their streak of victories, many historians have argued over the motivations of Charles VII not to intervene and not to try to save or buy, pay a ransom for Joan of Arc. However, after she was actually burnt and Charles VII eventually got the territory back in the north, he opened a new, he asked for a new trial under the supervision of Rome. And this was granted. And the second trial of Joan of Arc in 1956 basically proved that she was not a heretic. So she was rehabilitated by the church, a Roman Catholic church. And later, the church would agree that she had lived according to the Catholic rules. And she had shown, not only devotion, but extreme courage. And she had, acted in good faith. So in 1894, it's Pope Leo XIII, he declared Joan of Arc a true servant of God. And in 1904, she became a saint. Mm. Well, actually, I'm sorry, 1920, she became a saint. 1920.
In the aftermath of her death and the conclusion of the Hundred Years' War, did Joan of Arc become a folk hero in France of sorts, or some type of like nationalist figure? Or did that take time for her legend to fully cultivate?
Well, in the South, especially in Orleans, she since she lifted the siege of Orleans, she became a national folk hero. Well, national, local folk hero. She came into she became a national, meaning that for the whole country, a national hero, I would say, in the 19th century, as France was becoming more nationalist. But it is interesting to note that it was not necessarily people from the right who started talking about Joan of Arc as a hero. People from the left, because if you remember, it is at the end of the 18th century that the French Revolution occurred. And the left basically wanted to give an idea of citizenship. And the idea of citizenship was very linked with the concept of a nation, of a country. And Joan of Arc embodied the principles of a nation. So she became associated with the left, but also she became associated with the right at the end of the 19th century, I would say, with the rise of nationalist leagues. We saw her as a model, because let's remember that basically St. Joan of Arc said, I don't hate the English. I like the English when they're at home, but here it is France. So my mission is to send the English back home. So this is how she became adored by nationalist leagues at the end of the 19th century. And those nationalist leagues at the moment were very anti-German. They were very Germanophobic. So St. Joan of Arc was a symbol of not only nationalism and national unity, but also of promoting national defense against a foreign foe, which was in this case, Germany.
Mm. That is rather peculiar as well, because I was almost under the impression that the left, especially given their tendency of trying to erase a lot of like medieval history or just any type of historical period that goes against their progressive narrative, that they would actually try to preserve Joan of Arc, was in the French Revolution, like, because I was going to ask you something about that too, where like the radical elements of it, like say like the Jacobins or the Girondins or other groups, were they favorable towards Joan of Arc, or were they willing to dispense with her legacy?
That is a very good question, and I don't want to go into that because I'm not knowledgeable about this. I would say that the first times that I'm aware of that radical elements, like from the revolution, decided to use St. Joan of Arc as a national symbol would be in the at the beginning of the 19th century. Because what is important to note is that France, in the Ancien Régime, like when it was a king, France was extremely divided. There was no, it was not like one language, one currency or anything like that. It was pretty much a semi-autonomous region. So St. Joan of Arc became kind of a symbol of national unity. So this nationalism was something like supported and promoted by the left of the 19th century. So this is why she became a this is why they were interested in her.
That's a good point you raise, because it's generally assumed by most people who are accustomed to the current nation state model that during like the 17th to I would say late 18th century, that all states were coherent states, when it was not really the case. Like the Peace of Westphalia, like, was what more or less laid the groundwork for the emergence of the modern day nation state. But it took over, I'd say, almost two centuries for that whole process to crystallize. So that does make sense how Joan of Arc really was more of a regional folk hero at first. And so you could make me say, like, in like the Catholic community, she, her legacy transcended borders, if you will, but really she was a folk hero. But then like in the 19th century against the backdrop of like an emerging nationalism, you could definitely see why she became like a national hero. But that is a good point you raised there, that most European countries, even like Spain, for example, too, there's a lot of regionalism, and it wasn't until industrialization and mass communication that you were able to build a coherent nation state.
Yeah, totally. And if we think about like Italy was actually unified in 1861. We tend to forget it, but it's not that long ago.
No,
it was mostly like autonomous regions.
Yep, and there wasn't a singular Italian language, as you will. There was a lot of regional languages in Italy as well. That was another one of the biggest challenges for the Italian state. And that, this is like a theme of European history in general. Now, kind of like tie a bow into all of this, what is the conventional historical perspective now of Joan of Arc?
Well, some people from the far left have tried to make her the first transgender hero, which she was in the indication of her pretending to be a man. But now, kidding aside, if we're thinking about her legacy right now, the message of Joan of Arc is extremely simple. God loves everyone, but in his own country. And no one should invade other countries or try to rule. And she is very clear that she's not motivated by hatred. She's not motivated by any kind of resentment or anything. What she wants is solely for the good of her nation, for the good of her own people. And this is something that she explains in her trial in Paris, that she is not driven by negative feelings, but really by the desire to see her people free, and that it is the will of God to see every country rule by its own, according to its own rules, and for the good of its own people. And this is why she became such a popular hero among the nationalists and identitarian of during the last 40 years.
That is really curious, that overlap as well, because France does have a rather peculiar tradition where you see from the left to the right that there is like a strong like nationalist undercurrent to it. And yeah, they obviously have disagreements on like the nature of like the individual and the state and how like the economy should be run, but there is still like this national undercurrent. And was Joan of Arc ever held in high esteem by, say, like the French Communist Party and other socialist movements in the 20th century?
In the 20th century, I would say that at the beginning of the 20th century, she was pretty much, especially during the First World War, I wouldn't go for the communists, but socialists definitely celebrated her as well. Radicals, nationalists, and socialists alike celebrated her as a national figure. During the First World War, the government was trying to find symbols that would heroes, figures that would try to foster the engagement in the war, and Saint Joan of Arc was definitely one. They also, France is very secular as a republic, and they're very proud to be secular. They have a lot of laws about secularism, and it's not the same secularism as it is conceived in the United States. But nevertheless, they had the Sacred Heart on many flags during the First World War, a little bit like, the Great Patriotic War for Mother Russia that was launched by Stalin. Mm-hmm. So it's patriotic feelings that were used to, from every side, to foster national unity in a time of crisis.
That makes perfect sense. Now, the history field is very strange these days, because as a historian myself, as someone that went to university to study history, I have noticed a propensity these days among historians to come with preconceived biases and other notions that affects like their ability to analyze history and then like impute their biases on like the accounts of like a historical figure from, say, Charlemagne all the way to Joan of Arc to even Napoleon or whichever figure. And have you seen a tendency now of historians trying to like retcon Joan of Arc's legacy, like demonize her or rewrite her overall legacy to suit their ideological biases?
Well, yes, but in France, there is a very strong tradition. There is a very, very strong tradition, and people have a lot of culture, generally speaking. History is being taught since like the early grades. The field of history in France is much more conservative than can be in the United States. Not because it promotes like conservative ideas, but basically because like, the Black studies or like the woke is a very, very wide and vague term. But there's no such thing as a woke history right now in France. There are people promoting ideas like this, but they remain on the margin of society and nobody takes them seriously. So the society of France, even if it is like much more socialist than the United States will ever be, it's very highly taxed, very left-leaning on several issues. However, when it comes to like history, it's much more conservative. They do have the feeling that they're living as a chain, and they like even the far left starts the country, like the narrative at 1789, the French Revolution, which is a few hundred years ago. So there is a tendency to relate to those traditions. And the movement, the global movement for history writing is mostly an English-speaking problem, if I would say.
We don't have yes, agreed.
Yeah, we don't have that many like people, historians. Well, we don't have real historians, like serious historians, who wish to rewrite Anglo's doom.
Yes, that's a really good point about the reference points that you brought up there, because in the U.S., for a lot of people, I would say for the historical consensus, which tends to be liberal, progressive, the U.S., like, history really didn't start either, like, at the end of the Civil War of 1865 or like the end of World War II, or more radical cases, the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s, which is more of like the radical, like anti-white left would generally have that as a reference point. Because yeah, like in US, it's very different. And that's one thing I've noticed from my basic readings of French history, that there is like this very strong baseline of civic nationalism that it's like transpartisan in nature, that covers almost all like every facet of the political spectrum in France.
Oh, definitely. And you're right to mention that it is mostly civic nationalism that is shared by every group in France. Like from the left to the right, they will all pledge allegiance to a certain conception of citizenship. And the word citizenship is very important because it comes back to 1789. French is a secular republic, not as a monarchy anymore. So it is extremely strong, and it is why secularism seen in France is not the same like secularism as seen in the United States or the Anglosphere, where it simply will be considered to be the neutrality of the state. While in France, it is much more than that. It is actually like banning religion. Well, not banning religion from public space, but it is there cannot be religious symbols in anything related to the state. So hijabs and the Muslim veils will be banned from schools, as opposed to the United States, where I think it's fairly accepted, and the rest of Canada as well.
Now, you're based in Montreal area, so I was meaning to ask, is Joan of Arc more popular in France or in Montreal areas?
That is a good question. Unfortunately, in Quebec, we don't have as much history. Well, we do have as much history, but people are not as knowledgeable about history as they may be in France. For a lot of people, our history starts in 1608 when Samuel de Champlain actually settled in Quebec City. But the thing is, St. Joan of Arc is part of our history as well. There are statues of St. Joan of Arc in Quebec. I think there's even a town called St. Joan of Arc. But her memory is definitely not alive in Quebec as opposed to in France. It is extremely rare that somebody in Quebec will talk about St. Joan of Arc or will celebrate her, except in the traditional Catholic circles.
What about other parts of the Francosphere? Because even with like decolonization and all of that, France does still have that kind of soft power element where it's able to transmit and maintain its culture in some of its former colonial possessions. But is it the same way, like with Quebec, that the tradition has somewhat subsided as well?
Well, I would say that the last, and I know that if I have listeners in French right now, they're not going to like what I'm going to say. But the last great figure of like French soft power was General Charles de Gaulle. Basically, Charles de Gaulle's objective was to build not a commonwealth like the British has built, but something kind of similar, a sphere of influence based on the French language. So Charles de Gaulle actually set up like international organizations for French-speaking countries with the former colonies around the world, and the objective was to be a counter power, a third position mm-hmm. between the Russian, the Sovietic bloc in the east, and the American-led coalition in the west. So it was basically an idea of a third power. But what we have seen. What we have seen in the last decade is French presence were very very weak, and they joined NATO after Charles de Gaulle had left it, and they also just their use of English, their constant use of English, they're bowing in front of English, they're using English as a reference, which is a shame. French used to be the lingua franca, it used to be language of reference. So the fact that French presidents will address other dignitaries in English is in itself very telling. So they have lacked that will of power, if you will. France is not as influential, culturally speaking, as it used to be. And this is very interesting when we're talking about the language, like the English language. If you think about it, many meetings of the European unions are held in English, although there is not a single country of the European Union that is an English-speaking country.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Yeah, and I've actually heard some debates, too, where people were wanting, EU officials were either wanting to go back to French, how it was like the language of international relations, especially amongst numerous royal courts, or even go back to Latin to unify. Well,
it was the language of the language of diplomacy. When we think about it, a lot of English monarchs were actually French. So the court. This is the reason why. For example, when we're talking about food. There's going to be like the cow, but the meat related to cow will be beef, which comes from French bœuf. It's going to be the same thing for the hog, the pigs that will give you pork, which comes from the word paw in French. Why? Because basically the English monarchs were French.
Yeah, the Norman invasion. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, French was held in high esteem. But now the problem is people like Emmanuel Macron, who basically is a banker. He's a banker with very little culture. So he sees English as more convenient, and convenience is the key for bankers and people like that. They want to talk business. So because they want to talk business, they think they must use English all the time. And it has become kind of a snub thing to be able to speak in English. And I have seen, friends, like French people in France, addressing each other in English because they were talking about business and they thought it was more convenient, which clearly will never be the case. If you're not going to speak a second language among each other to do business faster, like that's not a valid point.
Now, to conclude here, why do you believe that it's still important to disseminate the life story of Joan of Arc?
Well, it is important that Joan of Arc, that her story is known, that it's not just a statue here and there or a Catholic parish. Behind the name, there is a story. It is an epic story. It is a girl with a very humble, modest beginning in life, a very usual, very common childhood. And she followed her vision and she decided to go against all odds for what she thought was right. And in the end, she sacrificed her life, her very short life, that is. She sacrificed her life for what she believed in. And she had doubts before going to be executed. She definitely had doubts, but she nevertheless decided to go on, putting her beliefs ahead of her own life. And I think in itself, this is a very valuable lesson. She is a model of virtue and she is a model of devotion. It is extremely rare we meet such, a heroic example. It is proven, like what she has done, although her visions have never been like scientifically proven, what she did is proven, and she was a model. Nobody can. She had no fault. She was not a. She wasn't a liar. She was very courageous. So she is a model of virtue, and I think we can look up to her even now, especially now.
Fantastic stuff, and I think this is a good spot to bookmark this discussion. But before we depart, where can listeners of the Barnes Review follow your latest works?
In the English sphere, I mostly write for the Barnes Review and American Free Press. For Francophones, actually, you can send me an email at learfang@protonmail.com, which is learfang@protonmail.com. I am the editor-in-chief of a French-Canadian magazine, Le Harfang. So we pretty much analyze the current event based on a French-Canadian perspective. And other than that, I do contribute here and there to several media in France, but this might not interest the American listeners.
Again, Remy, thank you for taking the time out of your day, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I really enjoy your show. I hope it's going to last long.
And to our audience, thank you for tuning in. For the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.